The following audio is from Redemption Church. More information about our church can be found at www.redemptionchurchlacombe.org.
Thank you, Trent. Church family, good to see you. Take your Bibles and turn me to the book of Ezra, chapter 7. Ezra 7, and also as you turn there, find the book of Esther, which is just two books to the right of the book of Ezra, as we'll be studying those books together this morning. Today, what I want to talk about from this text is that God is the God of the backstory. What I mean by that, as we're going to study, is that oftentimes in what we don't see are things that God is doing. How many times in our own lives maybe that we're wondering if God is doing anything in our lives, if He's trying to solve this particular issue maybe that's in front of us. Or is He doing anything to work in this particular individual's lives? Or you're working hard to be able to get to the next step or whatever it may be in regards to relationship or whether it's work or whatever it may be. And you're wondering, is God doing anything? And today what I want you to see from this story that we see here in Ezra 7 as well as in the book of Esther is that God is the God of the backstory, meaning that He doesn't always tell us what He's doing. We're not necessarily required that, or He's not required to tell us what He's doing for us on our behalfs. We have to trust. That's what faith is all about. If we were to actually to see everything that He's doing, many of us may not even follow Him, honestly. Because if we saw some of the things that He was doing and preparing us for, we would say, I can't do that. But God prepares us for the next things, so that when you get there, you're able to take care of those things, and you're able to handle those things. But oftentimes in our lives, we're wondering, God, are you doing anything in my life? Or God, are you doing anything in the church? God, are you doing anything in the family? God, where are you? And oftentimes that He is doing something in the backstory that is for His glory. Now, oftentimes what we're wondering in all of that really is, okay, what is it for me in that? Wondering oftentimes, okay, it's possible that when God is working, it's not just about you. There's a bigger picture in His whole plan than just you. The last time I checked, the earth doesn't revolve around me or you. God is the one who makes everything spin. God's the one who holds all the universe together. And yet, oftentimes in our thinking, we become very self-centered and very self-focused when we start thinking about things. Where, God, what about me? Hello, God, I'm down here. And often, maybe it's possible, as we're going to study this morning, that God might be using you as one piece to bring about something even greater than you. We're going to see that in the story this morning, that what we're seeing as we've learned through so far in the book of Ezra, the last time that we were here, when we were at Ezra chapter 6 last week, we saw that the people of Israel, remember, God had brought them from their exile. They were there in Persia and Babylon. The Persian government had taken over Babylon. The Babylonian Empire had crumbled, and God allowed them to go back. And some of them stayed, some of them were there. And the temple finally gets built, and they're celebrating. And we saw last week at the end of chapter 6 that a beautiful picture that He brings all of them back, not just for them, but so that other peoples and sojourners and other nationalities can also worship at the temple as well. So it wasn't just about the Jews. It was about God being worshipped by all people groups. And so then we pick up in chapter 7, and we're going to see that something is happening in this moment between chapter 6 and chapter 7. Often we would just read it and we think it's like the next day. But we're talking about years later when we pick up in chapter 7. And this is the backstory that we're going to study this morning. And that's why we're going to look at the book of Esther, because what we're going to see in chapter 7 is this one little phrase that Ezra gives us is actually covering years of history and years of the backstory of God working. So look with me at Ezra chapter 7, we're going to read verse 1 through verse 7, and then we're going to go back and then we're going to kind of unpack what this is, what the meaning is, and what is God doing back there. I want you to be encouraged this morning as believers. I want you to be able to leave today that if you're ever discouraged and you're ever questioning and you're ever doubting, I want you to rest in the fact of the theme of what we've been learning in the book of Ezra, that God is sovereign and He's not sitting on His hands. He's working and He's doing something for His good glory. Listen, everything in history is pointing to one thing, and that's the return of Jesus. So all that He's doing and all that we are a part of is for that culmination. It's not just for your next promotion. It's not just about your next pay raise. It's not about the next person that you're going to marry and how many children you're going to have. All of those things are simply pieces to the greater picture of Jesus Christ coming back. And we get to be a part of that glorious picture if we'll just tune in and be a part and willing to let Him use us. And that's what we're going to see today. Ezra chapter 7, verse 1, and we'll read through verse 7. Now after this, now what's preceded that was the temple built and them celebrating the Passover. Now after this, in the reign of Artaxerxes, king of Persia, Ezra, the son of Sariah, son of Azariah, son of Hilkiah, son of Shalem, son of Zadok, son of Ahitub, son of Amariah, son of Azariah, son of Mariel, son of Zeriah, son of Zui, son of Buki, son of Abishu, son of Hun. Yes, sir. What's the purpose of all that? The purpose is to get to the end of that verse in verse 5, son of Aaron, the chief priest. It's wanting us to know that Ezra is from the line of Aaron, the main priesthood that was started all the way back and Moses' brother. Because apparently there are other people named Ezra. It's quite likely that there are. And so he's wanting us to make certain that this is it. That's why in verse 6 it says, This Ezra went up from Babylonia. He was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses that the Lord, the God of Israel, had given, and the king granted him all that he asked, for the hand of the Lord, his God, was on him. Now, I'm going to whet your appetite because we're actually going to study that next week. But here's the point. We would never have chapter 7 if the God of the backstory wasn't taking place. That first few words of verse 1 is the point. Look at it again. Now, after this. Now, Ezra is just stating this, but actually, let's put some timetables for you. If you're taking notes, you may want to have this. It actually should be on the back of your sermon notes that we have the timeline that's there. The temple gets finished in 516 B.C. during the reign that Darius is king. Well, in chapter 7, Artaxerxes is now the king. Darius is out. But if we notice, when we see, if you go down to all the way down to verse 7 of Ezra chapter 7, Ezra is picking up in the seventh year of Artaxerxes. You know how many years has passed since then? About 58 years has passed. So when Ezra says, now after this, 58 years has passed from the time that the temple is finished and they're celebrating the Passover. But it's more than just saying time has passed. Something is taking place back in Persia that the people in Jerusalem are just doing their thing. They're working, they're doing their gardens, they're going to the temple, they're celebrating, they're making sacrifices. And some 800 to 1100 miles away, in all of those years, God is doing something for the greater good to be able to get to chapter 7. If He doesn't work in those 58 years to what I'm going to show you today to protect His people, there is no Ezra going back to Jerusalem. You say, what's the big deal about all that? What I want you to realize is it's possible that maybe you're even here because God did something in the background to your own story that you're completely oblivious to. You say, what do you mean? Maybe that one car that possibly could hit you and the angels of God were there to keep it steered away? You ever had those close calls before in life? My close call was when we were little, we're in the car and we're on the train track and we couldn't back up and the train is barreling down, slamming on the brakes and it's screeching, the brakes going, and I thought we were going to heaven right then. But in a split second, we back up and the train goes across. I wouldn't be here if the car behind us didn't back up. Are you with me this morning? There's a God of the backstory that we can't even imagine. I wonder what the angels are doing sometimes. You say you're a person of angels? Hebrews says that the angels are ministering spirits to those who love Him. I can imagine, you know, in that moment they're like, man, that was a close one. Look, angels aren't robotic. Yes, God, we will do this. You know? Come on, guys, y'all got to be with me, all right? God is working, and what I want you to realize is the Jews who were there planting their gardens, planting their whatever it is that they're doing, what's happening miles away, God is doing something so that He can protect them, so that the temple can still be there, so that people beyond the Jews can worship Him. He's doing something far away for their good. And I want you this morning to grasp that when you're just going throughout your day and you make it to the next day, I want you to realize we are a part of a glorious picture of the story of redemption. So what's that? I want to show you today in the book of Esther, because what happens at the end of chapter 6 and chapter 7 is the story of Esther. We talked about that in the very first sermon in the book of Ezra. This is what fits right there. You say, why isn't Ezra even mentioning that? Remember, Ezra is writing this. He is a scribe. He is a priest. So he is one who is a teacher of the law. And so he's writing back after all these things are done. And I believe it's not there because either he or Nehemiah wrote this story, and most of these things would have been put together in a historical situation. Most of them would have had Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah, and Esther all fit together. But we're going to study that this morning because I want you to see some of the pieces of what God was doing to be able to bring it to this particular point. So turn now to the book of Esther, and I want to show you about five or six truths from the book of Esther. We're going to summarize certain things this morning and then just bring some points from those summations so you can grasp that. Actually, I lied to you accidentally. Go ahead, turn to Esther, but I want you to go back to Ezra chapter 1. I want you to see the first truth to be able to get to where we are in the book of Esther. Because in this backstory, what I want you to see, the first thing in all of this, is that, remember in the story of the Jews, is that they were all kicked out of their land back in 586. They had to leave Jerusalem, had to leave Judah, and they were exiled to Babylon. Well, then when Cyrus becomes the king of Persia, he allows all the Jews, whoever wants to go back to Jerusalem, they can go. That's where we pick up in Ezra chapter 1. But if you remember, not every person says, I want to go. Look at Ezra chapter 1, verse 5. Then rose up the heads of the fathers' houses of Judah and Benjamin and the priests and the Levites, everyone whose spirit God had stirred to go up to rebuild the house of the Lord that is in Jerusalem. Only God stirred certain people's hearts to go. Remember, in chapter 2, we saw there were some 50,000 people of the Jews who did go back from the Persian Empire all the way back to Jerusalem. But there's a group of people who didn't go back. Now turn to Esther and let me put the dots together for you. In the book of Esther, we have two important people, Mordecai and Esther, that are still in Persia all of these years later, after the time that Cyrus allows them to go back. Remember, Cyrus is like 538 when he begins to rule. And then when this time of Ahasuerus is coming to rule, we have a lot of time that is passing. Some another 50-something years that is passing. But what we have, or some 80 years, excuse me, from the time that we have Cyrus, the time that we have Ahasuerus. I know it's a lot of different kings, a lot of different dates, but hear what I'm saying. Esther is going to be a very young lady when the time that she's going to be chosen to be queen. If she's a young lady, that means that she wasn't even born when the time that the option came for her family to go back to Jerusalem. She wasn't even around when God didn't stir her parents' hearts to go back. Let me put it this way. God caused her parents to stay so she could be born, so she could become the queen. Good morning. This is what I'm saying. She wasn't even around for the time that the decision had to be made. Will we go back to Jerusalem or will we stay here in Persia? But then there's also this other guy who's somewhat important in this story, named Mordecai. Now some say that he possibly went back, or he possibly wasn't born yet too. We're not exactly certain on that particular factor. Either way, if he's born or if he ends up staying, Mordecai is the cousin to Esther. He's older than her because he ends up raising her like she becomes his daughter. Now here's the thing. If he was born, let's go that route. If he was born and the option is for him to go back, then he's not there to be her support or to raise her. If he was born later and he was in Persia and the option still is for him to go back, the truth still stays the same. Here's my point. Often what God is doing is not just about you. Often what God is doing in the backstory might be for the generation that comes after you. Your faithfulness and my faithfulness is not just about me and you. That's why we say that we want to be able to make disciples of all peoples, because we want to raise up a godly generation so that even if I'm dead and gone, that my children and your children who become mighty men and women of God, maybe God's going to do something even greater than through them than even you or I. So it's a matter of our faithfulness and trusting. This is why it's important for us to realize, you say, okay, God is in control of my own backstory and your own backstory. So we understand God is the one who's orchestrating those things. So let's look at the second element that's happening. The second truth I want you to see from the book of Esther is that God does cause her then to become the queen and have favor with the king's servants. All right, remember, she's there in Persia. Let's actually read the story a little bit here. And Esther, if I say Ezra, I'm in Esther, okay? I've been saying Ezra for weeks now. Esther, 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 okay? With me? Just raise your hand if I'm wrong, okay? And just say Esther, okay? Ezra chapter 2, little summation here. Ahasuerus is the king. He's having a party. He's actually drinking way too much. He gets kind of tanked. And all of his friends are there, and he wants to bring out his wife to display all of her beauty to all of his friends. Because apparently she was a beautiful queen. She says, not happening. Well, her not happening doesn't turn out so good for Queen Vashti. There's an edict that's made by the king that says, fine, you're no longer my queen, and you're never allowed in my presence ever again. So then what happens is all of his servants are sent out across the entire province. We're not talking about in his city. We're talking about across his entire province areas of everywhere he rules. This is vast. This is going to be a huge project of what they're doing. They're going out to find all these young women to come in and basically have this beauty pageant. So then he gets to go through all these women to find out which one he wants to become his queen. So they're all there in the palace just waiting, one by one, one by one. Every night somebody goes in to be with the king, and then he finally picks somebody. But in that process, some are chosen, some are not. So what seems to be random is not random in God's eyes. We use the word coincidence way too much in our vocabulary as believers. What's happening here, even here, so remember, Mordecai is raising her, and hear this. This is not like a young girl volunteer says, oh, I'd like to try out for that. If the king says, you're coming with me, it's a decree, meaning it's not a choice. They're forced to go. And if they're not chosen, then they're forced to live in this particular building and their lives are pretty much ruined from whatever normality of what they wanted to be able to have. So in this moment of their choice, what I want you to see is that God is directing even the very person who is selecting her and then the favor that's placed upon her. So I want you to think about this. In your own lives, there may be some moments where things just seem to go very smoothly. And you're saying, why did that happen like that? It's in those moments where maybe the favor of God is just seeming to have His hand upon you to allow these things to take place. So let's pick up. Esther chapter 2, verse 8 through verse 11. So where we're picking up now is where I want you to see where favor is placed upon her and how that she is put to the list, if you will, the front of all of the ladies in regards for God to be able to do what He is working on doing. Esther 2, verse 8. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. Notice that phrase. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics, her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Understand what's happening here. He's giving her servants when all these others are just ladies in the pool. Esther, verse 10, had not made known her people, meaning that she's a Jew or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. You say, wait a minute, did he tell her to lie? No, he didn't tell her to lie. He told her to wait till the right time. Skip down to verse 15. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, meaning their cousins, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor, there it is again, in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year, remember that date, of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Why is she there? Because what God is doing in the background, again, that God is allowing her to be born there, her parents die, and Mordecai could say, hey, let's go back to Jerusalem when it's all easier, but he stays there to raise her, and then when she's chosen, of all of the hundreds, most likely, of the women, the one woman that finds favor is a Jew. Out of all the people. There's no randomness in this moment. What you see is God's sovereign hand to pick her, and then the guy that picks her has favor with her, and then gives servants to her, and then she's placed before the king. He still gets to know that she's a Jew. Why? Because God is waiting for the right particular time. God is ordering all of these things to be. Now, we'll be like a storyline. I'm going to let you hang on that just for a moment. Let's go to the next thing that God is developing in this. The third thing I want you to see that God is doing. Remember, this is all about the backstory of God protecting. Let me show you something else that God is doing at the same time. Remember, it says that Mordecai goes by the king's gate every day just so he could be able to communicate and hear what's going on. Well, he just so happens to overhear a story. Just so happens to. Third point is this. God causes Mordecai to overhear a plot to kill the king so that God can raise him to prominence, not then, years later. Look at the text. I feel like I'm telling this story like I'm so excited, and y'all are like, okay. I guess because I've been in it all week long, you know, just seeing all these little pieces of what God is doing. But so hopefully you get to the end, you go like, oh yeah. Esther 2, verse 19. Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred on her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. Now understand what's happened here. He's at the king's gate. He hears these two eunuchs who are upset the king. They're plotting to kill the king, basically. And so Mordecai hears it, and so it's not like he goes, "Oh, that'd be a bad thing, guys." He keeps his mouth shut, and he waits to tell the queen so the queen can tell the king. The king's life is spared. What happens as a result of that? Verse 23, when the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hung on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. The end. Okay, so it says it's hung on the gallows. Actually, and according to the Hebrew, if you remember when we're studying the book of Ezra, the way that the Persians do their torture, remember how they do their torture? They take a stick, they stick it in the ground, they sharpen the end, and they impale people. That's actually what that means. So these two men were impaled. And so then the story is just written down in the Chronicles of the Kings. Mordecai's not standing at the fence saying, "Hey, I saved your life. Hello, remember me, I'm out here. You're inside nice and all the grapes and all the good stuff. I'm out here. Hello." No, he's just faithful. And this is a lesson we can learn from Mordecai, by the way, is that we just trust that God is in control, that we trust that what we're doing is not just about us. Mordecai here realizes he's just trying to save the king. Why? Even though he is a God worshipper, he's still respectful to those who are in the authority, even though the king is not a God worshipper. It's a great lesson for us to learn, to respect those in authority and to be godly and to be so respectful to even those who were there. But I wonder if maybe some of you in this room might be Mordecai's. Meaning that God may not necessarily have you in a place of prominence, but that doesn't mean that God can't use you. God doesn't need everybody in prominence to be able to be used, but He needs people to just honor Him and to love Him and to be faithful right where you are and let God do the work and let Him be the one who chooses to raise you up or not. Because I don't want you to take from this story that just because Mordecai gets raised to prominence later is a guarantee that every person gets raised to prominence just because they do something great for God. He doesn't raise everybody up to prominence. He needs servants and He needs faithful workers. Let this text be your guide. Colossians 3:17 says, "Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God, whether it's in work or in deed." God is preparing. What God is doing here in this whole storyline is He's preparing and setting the stage for the protection of His people. All these little small details that He's coincidentally at the gate, He tells the story, is all for something that's going to happen, listen to me, 5 years later. 5 years later. Not next week, not next month. What is God doing? It's a lesson for us to be able to learn here that what God is doing may not be revealed to us next week. May not be revealed to us next month. But God is the one who's stirring us. And then after all of that's taken place, the next thing I want you to see is this. God then places Esther as the queen for a precise moment. For one major moment. Hear me. Put all the details together. Her parents stay in Persia. She's born there. They stay there. She gets chosen to be queen for one specific thing. One. And we want to do lots of great, grander things for God, right? Does anybody in the room want to be used by God? Used for God? Do great things for Him. Yes, we can do all of those things, but it may not be on a platform like Esther. It may not necessarily be that you're the queen and everybody else is looking to you, but God may have you in your life to do lots of small things, but there might just be one major significant thing that He has you here for. What a humbling thought. But sometimes we may not even know what that one thing is. You might stand before God. He says, "Hey, you remember that person that you talked to at Walmart? Yeah. This person led thousands of people to Christ because they ended up being a missionary in some particular country, in a closed country, and lots of churches got started because you shared the gospel with that one person. That's the way God works. I'm at least excited this morning, praise God. Esther 4. I want you to see that what's happening when we get to Esther 4 is after that Mordecai has discovered this whole story, this second guy that's in command shows up in this plot of the story named Haman. Oh, he's not a nice dude. He's the second in command to the king. Second in command. And so basically there's this rule that everybody's supposed to bow to him when he walks down the street. Now, Mordecai is a Jew. He's following what the word says, and the law say you're to make no one what? A god. He doesn't bow down. It stirs Haman up to the point of hatred. He wants to kill Mordecai. He puts a plot together so that he could be able to kill Mordecai. So he goes to the king, and he basically tells the king, he says, this is a chapter 3 story, he tells the king, he says, hey, there's this group of people, they don't do the laws of your land, and they're rebellious against you. Well, the king is not fully informed, and so what does the king do? He says, fine, you make your edict. And so Haman then creates a plan. He says, all of the Jews are going to be annihilated. They're going to be killed on a certain day of the month, 13th day of the 12th month, the end of their year. He says, they're going to all be killed, and we're going to pay the people even to do it. Talk about a plot assassination here. Hire for assassination. We're going to pay them to be able to do this. And so then the king is happy with all that. And then chapter 4 takes place. Mordecai learns about this and he mourns. He puts on sackcloth and he's at the king's gate in sackcloth, which is not supposed to be allowed. The queen finds out about it, sends a message to him and says, you need to change your clothes. This is not allowed. He doesn't do it because he wants to see God do something. And this is where things happen. He sends a message to the queen, and I want you to realize this. God has brought her here, and when she reaches the point where God can use her, she has two choices, fear or faith. Let me show you fear. Pick up chapter 4, verse 8. Mordecai also gave him a copy, meaning he's given the copy to the gentleman who's basically the messenger between he and Esther. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther and explain to her and command her to go to the king to beg his favor and plead with him on behalf of the people. We say, why doesn't she know? Listen, this is not because even though that she's the wife to the king, it's not like they're sitting down having breakfast and lunch and supper together every day. This is not like an ongoing relationship like you and I would understand in a marriage relationship. She has to be summoned to be able to come into his presence. So she has no clue of what's going on. Verse 9, and Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and commanded him to go to Mordecai and say, all the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law, to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. Do you hear what Esther is saying? Mordecai, you're asking of me to do something that may cause me to die. This is the moment of fear for her, and that aspect of knowing that her life may be on the line. She's a very young woman. She's less than probably 20 years old at this particular point. Mordecai doesn't let that go. Verse 12. Now she has a decision of faith. And they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. Because she's probably thinking, they don't know who I am. Let me translate what that means. Somebody's going to rat on you. Verse 14. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom, the famous phrase in the book of Esther, for such a time as this. Mordecai understands it. He understands the sovereign hand of God. He understands. He's saying, look, you're here for this particular time, but hear me, church. I want you to hear what Mordecai says. Look at it again there in verse 14. If you keep silent, relief and deliverance will rise. It's going to rise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Meaning, you might die if you don't step up, but at some point, if this is God's will for it to happen, He's going to bring it about. He will bring in a deliverer, but it won't be you. You'll miss the opportunity, but God will bring somebody. Believer, I don't want to miss the opportunity that God has for you and for me and for our church right now. Could it be that God has been doing great things in the years to bring us to this particular point, even as a church is bringing us healthy, bringing us unified for such a time as this? I have sensed for years that we're on the brink of a harvest. Could it be that we're at that such a time as this moment? What a powerful truth that this verse says. If you don't do it, somebody's going to step up, Esther. You know, you've had those moments when God has prompted you to share the gospel with somebody and you've been nervous and didn't do it. You ever walked away from those? Just to be honest, probably all of us in this room have. I have. Walked away miserable and then justified, well, somebody else will come behind me and do it. May God empower us to be bold to step when He says step. Do when He says do. Go when He says go. And in this very thing, I want you to know that God is working to bring all of this about. What does she say? Verse 16. Or verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law. If I perish, I perish. Mordecai then away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. You know, I don't think Mordecai would have left that gate if Esther would have sent back a negative reply again. He'd have been back and forth with that. He'd probably send that messenger, you go back to her again. And then she'd come back and he'd say, no, go again. And so then, you hear now she's gone from fear to faith to trust that what has been said to her has been true. How many people in this room have had Mordecai-type people speak truth like that into your life? That's been the encourager to you. That's been the one that said you can do this. Who's been the one that says step out in faith and do this and trust that God is in control. I thank God for having Mordecai-like people in my own life to push and to encourage. And here's what I want you to say. You may not be the Esther, but maybe God has you to be a Mordecai for somebody. To be the encourager. To be the one that's telling back to truth. To say, no, no, don't be afraid. Trust that God's in control and step out and do what God has called you to do. For example, if someone comes to you and says, hey, God's called me to such and such country. It's a closed country. I might die. And you say, if God's called you, go. I'll be here and pray and go. Well, the church will call you, will pray for you, go. Rather than being a person that says, man, I don't think that's really smart. You know, that's really crazy. You might lose your family. No one's going to be there to protect you. Don't be the bah humbug person. Trust God's sovereign hand. Well, remember that so-called event that took place when Mordecai overheard something? So she steps up. And then in chapter 5, let me summarize a little bit. She goes to see the king. God shows favor. Look at chapter 5, verse 1. On the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's quarters while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he helped out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. That had to be one of the dangerous moments of her life. Because she knew that as soon as she stepped in the chamber, it was either life or death in a moment. She waited, even though it's her husband, to see if the scepter will rise or whether or not she would be sentenced to death. I can imagine any of your heart's blood pressure in that moment. Probably her robe is pounding, waiting, trusting. But remember, she's been praying and fasting for 3 days. So she's stepping, not in fear, she's stepping in faith because she stands there to know if she dies, what Mordecai said, God's going to send somebody else to do the work. And God grants favor there. And so then what happens is this. He says, what's your request? I love this now. This is the great part of the story. And she, this is where now you know that she has favor. She says, won't you come and go make a feast? And I would like to invite you and Haman to come. She's good. She's real good. He says, okay. So they come. She prepares a feast. They're eating, they're drinking, and at the end of it, it's like, well, what's your request? And she says, well, if I can grant, have favor for you, I'd like to have another feast, and you come in at that particular feast, then I'll ask you my particular request. Now, Haman leaves, and all he's like walking on a cloud. He thinks, hey, nobody else got invited. I'm the only one that got invited. I'm all happy because he's thinking Mordecai didn't get invited. So he goes home. And when he goes home, he tells his wife and his friends say, hey, you know what you should do? You should build a gallows so that God that doesn't bow to you, you can kill him. His thoughts? That's a great idea. Because he thinks he's in with Esther. He knows that Esther and Mordecai are related. So he's thinking maybe that there's not a good relationship there. And so he's going to go do that. Well, in the meantime, God of the backstory is working again. And then the king goes to sleep in chapter 6 and he can't sleep. Let's read it. God causes him to not sleep at the right time. This is what's so good. At the right time. Specific day of this event. Good grief, it's so good. At the very next day that when Haman is plotting all of this stuff, it's the next day. Not the day before, not the day after, but the very night the king can't sleep. You say, why are you so excited he can't sleep? Because he reads something about Mordecai that happened 5 years before this very moment. Now keep in mind, this is not all about them. You got Jews back in Jerusalem who's oblivious to all this that's going on. And they're planting their gardens, they're doing their stuff, they're going to the temple as if everything is just fine. They have no idea what God is doing for them. None. How much more so do we have a clue? They have a clue to what all God is doing. If you're thinking you have nothing to be thankful for, thank God for what you don't know. You say, that makes no sense at all. It makes perfect sense to me. So when you say, I don't know what to be thankful for, you thank Him for what you have no clue about. That's going to sink this afternoon. I know it is. In chapter 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the books of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. Do you remember that deed that Mordecai did? Remember what book it got written in? That book. Now, listen, it's a chronicle of memorial deeds. Now, here's again, I want you to think of God's sovereign hand. This book is filled with lots of memorable deeds. But which page does he read? My gracious. Verse 2, and it was found. And it was found. Are you kidding? It wasn't just found. You know, the person who's reading this, what's the hymn? It's not like, Which page? I think we'll start page 1. No, it's like God has the book opened to right there because he knows it's time. He's like, okay, Ahasuerus, I made you not sleep. I'm going to make you read this page. I want you to read this story because you need to hear what's going on. What does he read? Verse 2. It was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, who sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Let me just ask you a question. If you read a memorable deed that happened 5 years ago and it was about your life being spared, are you really going to have to be refreshed about all the details? I don't think so. So the king says, well, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. 5 years of silence. Mordecai is not making it about him. He trusted what he was doing for God. And so then Haman strolls in. How timely. Remember, Haman thinks he's like top dog, right? So he walks in and the king says, hey, Haman, what do you think that we should do for the guy that's like the most important person? What's Haman thinking? Oh, man, he's about to do something good for me. So Haman's like, you know, I think what you should do is you could take some of the robes that the king has worn before and put him on the king's horse and ride him through the town and talk about how good he is. Oh, that next statement. King says, why don't you go get Mordecai and let's do that for him? Yes, sir. All because of the very moment that happened some 5 years ago, and God is doing all of this. And you say, why is all of this taking place? Because of what he's preparing to protect his people. Because what happens is this. When you get to chapter 7, remember that second feast? Esther has the king back and Haman back because Haman goes home that night after all that took place, after he has to walk Mordecai through the town on the king's horse in the king's robes, because when he gets back, guess where Mordecai goes this time? He goes into the king's place. And Haman goes home mortified and tells his wife, and his wife tells him, it's not going to be good for him. Now, I'm summarizing a lot. I hope to whet your appetite to go back and read this whole story. And so then, a feast takes place. The king comes, and Haman is there, and Esther is sharing the story, or sharing the meal with him. And finally, the king says, what is it that you request, Esther? And then she begins to unfold how that there is this plot to kill her people. And then she begins to then tell who she is in regards to what she's doing. Remember, Mordecai had told her years ago, don't say anything. Why? Because if she would have said something beforehand, guess what's going to happen to her? She's going to be next. So it's this very moment, the very moment of why she had to fast and to pray to seek God for the courage and the faith. And then it's in this very moment that she tells him who she is. And then she says, and that evil man right there is the one who is doing it. The king walks out of the room because he's hot, he's angry, he walks out. And then Haman then gets on his knees before the queen and he's begging for his life. Well, the king walks back in and he thinks that Haman is trying to assault the queen. So guess what happens to Haman? Remember that gallows he built for Mordecai? He built his own gallows. 50 cubits in the air. Do you know how tall that is? 75 feet. You see, Haman wanted everybody to know that when you don't bow to Haman, this is what happens to you. And God flipped that around and basically said, guess what? If you mock me, this will happen to you. And he's impaled. And then Mordecai is in place in the same spot that Haman was. Why? Look with me. Chapter 8, verse 1 through 2. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king. For Esther had told what he was to her, meaning, that's my cousin, he raised me, this is what he's done for me. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. Church, do you understand how important this very act is. If you take the signet ring of the king, it means you act as though you're the king. The things that you put in place are as an edict and a decree. Hear this. Here's an ungodly king who is giving a God worshiper, openly unashamed worshiper, the authority in his kingdom. God raised him up for one simple act of what he had done, and God is raising him up. Why? Because guess what's still in place? The edict that the king gave to destroy the Jews is still in place, and all those people are ready, and they're scattered throughout the entire province now. Throughout the entire thousands of miles of province. It's not like you say, oh man, I got to put them in a group text. Let me just text them real quick and let them know they can't kill the Jews. No. What happens? Go down to verse 7 and 8. Because Esther tells the king what's happening and all of that, the plot that took place. Because now he realized he's been snookered, if you will, in regards to doing his action. Then the king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Behold, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they hanged him on the gallows because he intended to lay hands on the Jews. But you may write as you please with regards to the Jews in the name of the king, and seal it with the king's ring, for an edict written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's ring cannot be revoked." What does he do? The rest of that chapter, he writes an edict that all those who were supposed to be killed could be freed. But guess what? Not every person who got the decree to kill him got the message that they couldn't kill him. So they had to write a decree to the Jews that you could defend yourself if somebody tried to kill you, because it's written by the king to defend yourself. Remember the Jews that are back in Jerusalem who have no idea what's going on? Now they know what's going on. And so now so they have to send messengers there to say, hey, by the way, there's these men that's coming to kill you, so you got to be prepared and ready. So the edict goes out, and God is preparing the way. And so they could be saved. All because Esther's family didn't go back to Jerusalem. Because they stayed in Persia. And because they stayed in Persia, and Mordecai stayed in Persia, it was so that he could protect the Jews and protect the place so that people, not just the Jews, could be able to worship him. Here's what I want you to see. The last thing I want you to see is this. God did all of this not just for the Jews, but he did it for all mankind. Why? Why do we say it's for all mankind? Because do you remember the leader that's in Ezra chapter 1 named Zerubbabel? He is of the line of Jesus. So all these actions of Esther and Mordecai and causing the king not to sleep and read the story to protect them is so that the Jews won't be annihilated. Why? Because the Messiah's got to be born back in the province of Jerusalem in Bethlehem. And God's got to do all these things some 500 years before so that the Messiah could be born there. Don't tell me God's not in charge of details. He's in charge of the backstory so that people and you and me, so when you're reading this story, it's not about Esther. It's not about the Jews. It's not about Mordecai. It's about so you and I could have redemption now in 2017 so the Savior could be born and so that all people could be saved. He's working in the backstory. Thank God for what He is stirring and moving and orchestrating. Who knows what God is doing in some other country, in some other people. All I know to do right now for me and for you, be faithful to the God of the universe. Be faithful to the sovereign God. Trust that He's in control. If your life feels like it's out of control and it's chaotic, listen to me. Trust God even in the seemingly chaotic moment. That maybe He's doing something else to bring you to where you need to be. Sometimes we have to go through some very, very hard times so that God can give us the strength to be able to endure maybe something that's even going to be harder down the road. Believer, you and I have a God of the backstory of our lives. when we think it's all about us and the universe is revolving around us, we need to step back a little bit moment and realize we're one piece to His big picture. This story that we've just said now makes sense when we get to chapter 7 of Ezra. It says, now after this, Ezra goes back. Remember, we're going to see this next week. Ezra is in Persia when this is all going on. And if the Jews get wiped out, guess the first place they're going to get wiped out? There in Persia, where the cluster of Jews are, and Ezra's in the mix. God was protecting him even in this so that he could go back so that the people could have a great teacher of the law of God. I'm giving away next week. Next week, that's what we're going to study, okay? So you, what's the point I want you to see here? Maybe you're wondering why in the world I am at where I'm at. Listen to me. I want you to see you were born in whatever year that you were born because God wanted you born that year. Why am I a part of this family? Because God wants you there. Say, I don't want to be a part of that family. Could it be that God has you there for such a time as this? You say, my family's hard. My family's difficult. Well, God has you there for a reason. Why am I at this workplace? I don't want to be at this workplace. Flip it around. Why does God have you there? What opportunities are you missing? Why are certain things not working out the way that you want them to, when you want them to, how that you want them to? Maybe you need to stop worrying and start resting that He's in control and doing something that you or I can't see. If you're here this morning and you are questioning even the existence of God and whether or not He really is real, I want you to hear this detail. The God that we're talking about is not a God who started creation, started the universe, and just spun it on its axis and just stepped back and just watched it. You read details like this, those things can't happen coincidentally. It's impossible for all those details to come together over all those hundreds of years for a king to read something on one specific night. There's no way that's coincidental. I want you to see that God is involved in your details. Submit your frustrations. Submit your details. God's big enough to handle your and my questions, by the way. Your doubt, your concern. But maybe this morning some of you need to be like Esther. Maybe there's some things that God is calling you to be and to do, and you're scared and fear is driving you rather than faith. Maybe you need to be like Esther and spend some time fasting and praying and seeking the face of God and let His direction then tell you what you need to do and then step even if it means something difficult or challenging to do. Maybe God has you to be like a Mordecai. Maybe you thought that your role of not being prominent was not that important, but maybe God is telling us from this particular story that God is reminding you, encouraging you to not be afraid to read the truths and tell people the truths of God when someone comes into your life, that you need to be that encourager, that faith giver. Be a Mordecai. Trust that God is in control. Maybe you're not even a Mordecai, maybe not even an Esther, but you feel like you have no rule at all, no particular place. I want to tell you, if God has you here and you're breathing oxygen and you're a believer and you're a child of God, He has a place for you. He has a reason for you. You say, what is that reason? He's created all of us for the glory of God. Live for the glory of God. Let that be your fame. Let that be your thing, that your anthem that you're living for. Whatever I do, word or deed, I live for the glory of God, and let God use you greatly. You know, I was just thinking about this week, the illustration that came to my mind to help us to understand this is when our kids were younger than they are now, we had these plastic gears with magnets that they would be on the refrigerator. They put all these gears together. It was awesome to see their amazement that when you turned one, it turned this one, and that gear turned this one, and that gear turned this one. They all were turning at the same time to impact the gear at its furthest distance away. I don't know where you are in the gear mechanism, but I do know that God is the one controlling the turning of the gears. And you and I need to rest in God's sovereign hand over our lives, over our relationships, over our work, over our families, and trust that even when you can't see on the things that you don't know, let's praise Him for the things we don't even know or understand. Let's pray. Father, I am simply amazed. I'm thankful. I worship You for this study for me personally this week. To once again be reminded in this great story of Ezra, of You bringing people back to Jerusalem to build the temple, to worship, that yet miles away You were still working through Esther and Mordecai for a bigger picture than just them. You are indeed the God of the backstory. God, for believers in this room this morning, maybe who came in here wondering, what in the world is their purpose in life? Maybe they came in here feeling like it's all over. There's no hope. God, I pray today that from the truths that we have heard, that You will inspire Your people to realize that You are the one working, even when we cannot see it. God, I pray that if there are, and ask You, that if there are any individuals that where You are challenging them, much like Esther had a decision of fear or faith, and God, I pray that You would empower and encourage the believers to step in faith and not fear. God, if there are individuals in this room who felt like their whole lives, that they've just been behind the scenes and maybe they've felt unappreciated or unimportant, God, even today, even as we've seen how Mordecai was used, may You help us just to be faithful. God, if there are any in this room who question Your sovereign hand, question Your existence, God, may the power of Your Word help them to see that You are in control of the tiniest details, even to a king's sleep. God, make us rest in You. Encourage us by these truths. We thank You. You're the God of the backstory. In Jesus' name. Amen. As we stand and as we respond, Jared and I will be here. Jerry will be here as well. If you need prayer this morning, you come. If you need just to sit where you are, stand where you are, respond to whatever it is that God has given you, you respond.